You're listening to the Round Table Podcast, episode 17. Hello, literary alchemists. I'm Dave Robertson.
And I'm Doc Coleman, once again, filling in for Brian Humphrey.
And you're listening to the Roundtable Podcast.
Each week, writers are invited to come on the show and present a story idea to us and our esteemed guest host.
And then we dig into it. We discuss it. We work through theme and character, plot arcs, and anything that strikes our creative whimsy, hoping beyond hope to transform a raw, nascent idea into literary gold. Or, Doc, what were you calling it?
We're mining the pyrite of spec fiction to find literary gold.
Oh my God, yes. That's awesome. Awesome. And Doc, thank you so much. Yes, Brian is still gallivanting off in the mountains of Colorado somewhere playing Nature Boy. I picture him with twigs in his hair and rags on his body, grunting and snorting like a wild boar.
Do you picture Brian like this often?
Tell me about your mother. Yes. Doc, what's going on in your life, man? I know you, at the time this thing drops, it's going to be several weeks later, but you just got back from Balticon, right?
Yep, I just got back from Balticon, and boy, are my arms tired.
But seriously, folks.
Okay.
Tell us about the galley table. I want to hear about the galley table.
Okay. I'm a member of another writing podcast. That's the Galley Table. That's a production of Flying Island Press. And there we also talk about writing, but that's more of a big roundtable discussion where we talk about different aspects of writing. Sometimes we have guest hosts from the writing and publishing and podcasting industries, and sometimes it's just those of us among the crew either talking about writing or just talking about different aspects of geek life and rambling on for an hour or so before we call it quits.
Give us a URL.
Spring that on me.
Oh, kazam!
It's because they have an ugly URL, and let me tell you why.
Okay. Well, I'll fill in the gap while you.
I've got it. I've got it.
Okay.
Just let me bring it up. So that's you can find Galley Table at flyingislandpress.com/flagship/category/galley_table.
Oh my God. Dude, you need to trim that sucker down.
If it was up to me, I would. But okay. I'm the one person on the Galley Table who is not actually formally associated with Flying Island Press.
You're the stowaway. Right.
I came on the show on the second episode as a guest, and they said, come back anytime. So I did.
The guest that wouldn't leave.
Yes, the guest that wouldn't leave. That's me, the stowaway of Flying Island Press's Galley Table.
Well, Flying Island Press is awesome in and of itself. And friends, if you haven't tuned into the Galley Table, do make that scene. Not only are they a charming and witty bunch, but they offer many keen insights. And you get a grassroots view of the writing process. It's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of awesome, let's roll on, shall we?
Okay.
Excellent. Returning to the round table, taking up the finest chair at the head of the table, tea and wine set beside her, we have the author of Alchemist of Souls, the first book in the Nightmask trilogy, put out by Angry Robot Books. Please welcome back to the round table and on the Skype line, Miss Anne Lyle. Mrs. Anne Lyle. See, this is the part where Dave should do his research just a little bit before he gets on the Skype line.
Hi, Dave.
Hi, Anne. Thanks for coming back. We appreciate it. So, Anne, what's you've got Alchemist of Souls out. It has nothing but glorious reviews out on Amazon. And I don't know if you actually go out to your Amazon list, but I'm always intrigued by the stuff that people are also buying other than your book.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Well, I saw, and here's, friends, if you have not twigged to the awesomeness of Anne's novel, people are also, when they buy Anne's novel, they're also buying stuff by Neal Stephenson, Greg Bear, Elizabeth Bear, and Chuck Wendig. So, Anne, you are in fine company.
I am indeed.
So what's on the Anne Lyle desk? What's on your to-do list? What's coming up that that the world needs to know about from Anne Lyle?
Well, obviously, I'll have the book out, which came out in paperback and ebook at the beginning of April, and it's now out in audiobook.
Really? Who did the voice?
It was Michael Page, who did the Lies of Locke Lamora.
Oh, awesome.
So he's very good, yeah. So that's out on Audible and Amazon and iTunes.
Oh, my goodness.
Just this last week.
That's
so outstanding. Yeah, if you prefer an audiobook, you can still enjoy The Alchemist of Souls.
Yay. And we will include links to all of that in the liner notes for the episode. That's fabulous.
I'm just finishing off the second book, which is called The Merchant of Dreams, and that's slated for a mid-December, December the 18th release in the US and an ebook, and in the new year as a UK paperback.
Excellent. How did that happen? How did the US happen to score that quicker than the UK? That's insane.
It's the way that Angry Robot have their books are distributed in the US by Random House.
Okay.
And I guess it's a scheduling thing, but Random House usually put books out at the end of the month. And of course, the end of December is Christmas.
Right.
And they don't want books coming out on Christmas Day.
No, so that makes no sense at all.
No, so they brought it out a week beforehand. But also they can't do anything about the UK date because that's just after New Year. So Excellent. For once, there is a bigger gap than usual between the two books.
Excellent. So friends, a week before Christmas, leave a couple of gaps in your Christmas gift-giving list because Merchant of Dreams will be making the scene, at least here in the US. That's awesome.
Yes. And one final thing I will mention for your US listeners, I'm going to be coming to WorldCon.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
Excellent.
Yes. So, me and a bunch of the other Angry Robot authors, so Adam Christopher and Chuck Wendig and Morris Broaddus and a few others are going to be there.
So it's going to be an Angry Robot invasion of Worldcon.
Absolutely.
The visual on that is just too priceless.
This just in, Angry Robots invade Worldcon.
Now, I wanted to ask, Anne, do you have a title? I mean, Alchemist of Souls is a very evocative title. Lovely. Mm-hmm. And then Merchant of Dreams. Oh, my God. That is also evocative. Do you have a name for the third book?
Yep. It's called The Prince of Lies.
Oh, escalation on an epic scale.
Indeed.
Awesome. And any even inkling of when that might be gracing the bookshelves?
I think we're looking at autumn 2013.
Oh,
something like that. Yeah. My initial handover deadline is the end of this year.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's the kind of ballpark.
So, friends, pace your passions. Mm-hmm. Be prepared.
And don't be afraid to pre-order.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Pre-ordering, always welcome in the publishing industry. Very cool. Anne, are you attending any other conventions besides WorldCon?
I'll be at FantasyCon. Okay. Which is a UK convention in the lovely seaside town of Brighton.
Lovely.
In late September. I think booked in to do EasterCon, which again is a UK convention next Easter. And I'm going to be at World Fantasy 2013, which is being held in Brighton this next year.
How convenient. Excellent.
Yes, indeed.
Excellent, excellent. All right, fans, mark your calendars. Anne's going to be at those locations, and we'll include links to those in the liner notes as well. And speaking on behalf of any American who loves fine fantasy, we're so glad you're crossing the pond for Worldcon. That's going to be beyond awesome. Very cool. Well, Doc, Anne, let's take a pause here, if we can. We'll take a short break. Promotional break for another awesome podcast or audiobook. And when we get back, we'll workshop some stories. Sound good?
Mm-hmm.
Sounds good.
Excellent. Friends, stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Big Anklevich.
And I'm Rish Outfield.
And that's R080T.
We're your hosts for the Dunesteef Audio Fiction Magazine.
On the Doomsteve, we read science fiction, fantasy, and horror stories.
What did he say?
He says that you're a loser. If you've never listened to the Doomsteve, you don't know what you're missing.
Stupid, worthless robot. After the story, there's witty banter and discussion from the hosts. What did he say this time?
He says that you're a loser. The best part about the discussion is that it's at the end, so it's easy just to skip it.
Right, so come check out the Doomsteve audio fiction magazine.
Find us at www.doomsteve.com.
That's Doomsteef. What did he say? That I'm a loser?
No, he said that if you check out the Doomsteve, you'll be glad that you did.
Huh.
And he said that you're a loser.
Friggin' robot!
All right, friends, welcome back. Thanks for sticking around. And here, dear Doc, my guest co-host, is where we dive into the awesomeness that is the Roundtable Podcast, if I do say so myself.
You do.
I do, and often. the meat and potatoes, the dare I say, the thrust of the Roundtable is talking about story ideas and transforming and digging in and finding the real gold and bright, sparkly things that are inherent in every idea. And to do that, we need a guest writer. Doc, would you be so kind as to introduce the charming and lovely guest writer we have for this particular episode?
It would be my pleasure. our guest writer for this episode is one of the premier voice talents in the podiosphere. She has been a Parsec finalist twice for her work with the Secret World Chronicle. She was a Parsec finalist for the Best New Podcasting Team for The Ballad of Iron Percy with Edward Clark. She is a writer of many talents, having written for the Secret World Chronicle along with Mercedes Lackey, Cody Martin, Dennis Lee.
Respect.
She has also written her own comic adaptation called The Keepers that is available from Incubator Press with art by Martino Abreu. Hope I pronounced that right. And she has got a new story out on Smashwords called Fear of Thought that rumor has it is going to become a full cast audio production sometime later. But,
holy crap.
And may I introduce the lovely and amazingly talented Veronica Jaguar.
Hi. I'm looking behind me going, is there somebody else? No, that's just me.
Wow. See that? And that's a common reaction. We've achieved, that's what we call the round table effect. Doc, you have done us proud. Well done, sir.
Thank you.
V, welcome to the show. And if you would be so kind, tell us where you're at. What do you do? Do you have a day job? And what inspired you to get into this bizarre craft?
Okay. I do have a day job. I tell college students what to do.
Oh, what fun.
And when they don't do it right the first time, I have to tell them again. So,
is there martial punishment involved at all?
It might make it easier if it was.
Okay. Just asking.
No.
They might enjoy that too much.
They might. So that is my day job. I work in higher education.
Excellent.
And I got into writing initially because I was bored and I wanted to do something more portable than theater. I did college theater and community theater. But then when I started with the family thing, it's kind of hard to make it portable. So sure. Writing is portable and voice acting is portable.
Excellent. Yeah, and here's Veronica, another theater person.
Veronica is an amazing voice actor. She has the capability of melting men's hearts and chocolate with only her voice.
Wow. never mind shattering glass with your singing voice. Melting chocolate, that's an accomplishment. That's amazing.
Yes.
So V, let's get into this. You brought a story to the table, yes?
Yes, I do.
Excellent. All right, so like every other guest writer on our show, you have 5 to 8 minutes. Give us the title, the genre, the format to lead off with, just so we know what we're talking about. Introduce us to some of the primary characters, pro tag and antag. Give us a story arc, whatever you have, and we'll take it from there. The mic is yours, my lady.
Okay. The story title is Ezathan of Wetherby Shores.
It is fantasy, not quite magical fantasy, but probably more alternative history fantasy. The snippet, I guess, is the heir of the Wetherby shipyards begins her apprenticeship abroad, only to become the center of a merchant's plot to blaspheme the craft and take control of sea trade. In this setting, the idea is that shipbuilding and sea trade are actually forms of worship. That's the religion centers around the sea and sailing the sea. So building a ship, being a captain on a ship, being part of a crew, that's sort of like a holy calling in this setup. The main character, the title character, is Ezefin Aliburn, or Safi, because everybody needs a nickname. At the beginning of the story, she's preparing for her apprenticeship at Lady's Heart Monastery. She is the daughter of the head of the Wetherby shipyards. And it's expected that she is going to go to the monastery and apprentice and then come back and take up the mantle of head of the Wetherby shipyards. She has never been away from home, so she is going out to the monastery to learn her trade, apprentice at some of the other yards around there, and then come back. She is also going there with her cousin, Riddick. He is the son of a ship captain. He is going to Lady's Heart so he can learn the lore and the craft of actually running a ship. His mother is a captain. He has never met his father, has no idea who he is, and he's not so keen on the idea of devotion and lore. He's more along the science and navigate by the stars, and nothing is going to come out of the water and get me. You people are all crazy. And he's very bitter because this lore has kept him from his mother. There's a lot of myth that I've started to put together underneath that literally keeps him from sailing with his mother and traveling back and forth. Initial conflicts between the devotees and those who want to go against that lore that actually drives shipbuilding and trade. One of those is that everything in Wetherby is done by hand. The very, very simple machines, the country where Wetherby is, the kingdom is way off in the center of the island. Wetherby Shore is your standard little nice seafaring village. People have gone overseas, so your colonies are where you're seeing this new steam power. So what I'm trying to do is present steampunk as the blasphemy, I guess. So you're using steampunk as, no, this goes against lore and tradition. How dare you use this? Of course, as there are ships, there are pirates. So one of the other conflicts is that pirates have taken the blaspheme one step further by using the steam craft and steam machinery to make airships. So pillaging and piracy actually involve retrofitting the ship and swooping down from above. This is terrible, horrible. We do not think of these things. There are also some desert kingdoms that are trying to resolve this idea of steam power, but making it fit within their interpretation of the lore. My main villain is Terrace Detwork. He meets Ezefin and Riddick when they first get to Lady's Heart. He presents himself as a merchant's son, but he really wants to own and partner with these shipyards. He wants to be able to pretty much own the sea trade between the colonies and the main kingdom. He's not a fan of lore and legend. He wants wealth, power, piracy. He wants to be able to take these ships and retrofit them for sea and sky. Ezefin is the key to the Wetherby shipyards. He figures if he gets her, he's got the yards no matter what, and he'll slowly seep his way in. And her cousin is an annoyance to be managed. There's another character who comes in at the beginning, Khalil, who is part of these desert kingdoms. And there is a friendly partnership between the desert kingdoms and Wetherby Shores for trade, of course. The world that I've got there is about 80% ocean, lots of little islands, so you need a ship. And some of the conflict involves Khalil and Riddick kind of feeling each other out, Ezathan and Khalil feeling each other out. And during the process of the story, Riddick, what I'd like to see him do is forsake the entire lore and legend. I'm not going to do this anymore. And leave, leaving Ezathan to fend for herself with Taris. And then to realize, oh, he wants to do this? Crap, now I've got to get out of it. I'm currently trying to figure out, do I need romance? I'm trying to figure out if the steampunk is forced. And I'm trying to figure out if I've got too much for one book.
And just a quick question. Do you see an end game? Do you see how the story ends?
I do. One of the endings that I have is that Riddick and Khalil wind up teaming together to help Ezathan get back. And Khalil actually offers her a position with the Setere airship yards, Setere being the desert kingdom. And I'm trying to figure out, does she stay there in the desert and build a life there? Or does she go back to Wetterby and to the tradition and lore where home is?
Okay. Okay. Excellent. Excellent. Well done. Under 8 minutes, you rock. And there's a lot of good meat here. So before we give the standard disclaimer, let me give you this opportunity, V. What are you hoping to get out of the ensuing conversation?
To kind of refine the direction and to get a path that goes into manageable chunks. I'm lousy at romance. I'm great voicing it. I'm not really good at writing it. So okay. To figure out if that is an appropriate tool for this and to make sure that I have a proactive protagonist. I think one of my other questions deals with voice, because I'm not sure if I should switch between Ezathan and Riddick's voice or just keep a consistent point of view throughout the whole thing.
Well, we have the perfect guest host to pose those questions to. Before we start the discussion, Doc, are you familiar with our standard disclaimer?
Why, yes, I am. The standard disclaimer for the Writers Roundtable podcast is that anything and possibly everything that we say could be complete and total bullshit. So... take it with a grain of salt.
Absolutely. Given, offered in the spirit of creative discourse and exploration only, might be complete and total twaddle. Use it at your peril. Okay?
Yes, sir.
Good. Then we always defer opening comments, opening questions, and observations to our guest host. So, Anne, what did you think of Veronica's story idea? What questions do you have? Start us off on this wild ride that no doubt will ensue.
Okay. My first thought, it sounds interesting. Personally, I find ships very difficult to write, but other people think they're, you know, do great things with them. So
how come? Out of curiosity.
I have ship voyages in my second book, and I found them very difficult in that there are only so many things that can happen at sea.
Ah.
I prefer land-based adventures, but there
okay.
you go.
Okay.
But I like reading about them, so
perfect.
You know, if you can make them interesting and exciting, I'm in there. Setting. As a scientist, I'm slightly concerned about whether you'd actually have deserts on a world that only had 20% land.
Good point.
I think you'd need some big mountains to create a rain shadow.
Okay. So you're looking at more at something island, plateau. Okay.
Yeah, whichever part of the world the desert's in, I think you need some mountains between it and the prevailing winds.
Okay.
Somewhere for the rain to fall, because there's going to be a lot of rain and a lot of storms on a planet that has only that much land. I mean, one of the reasons that the Cape of Good Hope is such a nasty place is because there's a lot less land in the southern hemisphere, and so the wind and the waves can just go round and round and round around the bottom of the world with nothing to stop them. yeah, it's gonna be a nasty, stormy place. But that's cool because you can, have some fun with, you know, huge dramatic storms and things.
Now, and if, if she had like a large primary, you know, like let's say 15% of that 20% was a single continental mass, with the remaining 5% made up of smaller habitable but smaller islands scattered around it. Would that fulfill the science end of things, do you think?
That might be, but you might have like half the world where like nobody goes because it's just this hideous maelstrom, and maybe that's part of the religion. Because this whole part of the world where you can't go. I know, maybe the steamships are powerful enough to go there. Maybe there's places no one has ever gone because the ordinary sailing ships can't go there.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Another possibility, it seems to me, is that your continents don't necessarily have to be big, as they have to be long in terms of the path of the prevailing winds, so that you can't have a short range of mountains that scrapes all the moisture out of the clouds, and then you've got a stretch of desert which could still have ocean on either side, so you can't have desert realms that still have access to the sea.
Okay. And V, I wanted to ask, why a desert realm? What was it that you were looking for in there that would enhance or was vital to the story?
I wanted a different spot that was so opposite where Ezithen comes from. She comes from the I'm utterly terribly in love with Newfoundland. I can't explain it. It's a lot of sea shanties and horribly romanticized sailor tales. So that's kind of what I'm looking at, where Wetherby actually is. So something that's so opposite that. And I wanted to have Khalil in this dry, arid place where you don't have the romance that goes along with the sea and ships. It's like, yeah, that is not in my backyard, and I don't really like it. I'm just going to put up with it.
Okay. One thing that strikes me then, if we go with Anne's idea of having there be that maelstrom of you know, turgid, flowing, frothing wind and rain and wetness that no one's been to, perhaps working a polar opposite of that and have Khalil come from this other end, you know, make it a desert realm by all means, but I'm thinking thematically of drawing this world with two polar opposites, this parched, arid end on one end, and the maelstrom of water and storm at the other end, and having your protagonists start in the middle with these two ends drawn tightly might give you some interesting thematic venues to pursue.
Okay.
Thinking along those lines. Doc, what do you have for first impressions?
Again, I was interested in the Desert Kingdom and the idea of we've painted a situation where the area that the main character comes from is very much wrapped up with a worship of the sea. It's very tight in their religion and culture. And I wonder about the desert kingdoms. What's their culture and their religion?
The way I'd had it first is they actually go from the same basic myth. There's one standard creation-esque myth, and whereas the kingdom where Wetherby is and the colonies that follow after it, they follow the maternal side of that myth. The desert kingdoms look at the son of the matriarch and how he survived and created this other land-based kingdom. So there's an acknowledgement that they share a common beginning, but the point of worship differs.
Because part of it is, the first thing I see is like if you've got a society that very much worships the sea, then doesn't that tend to make desert people the damned?
Yes.
Ooh, that's an interesting perspective.
So then it becomes an interesting thing of how do you relate to these people from this desert kingdom? You know, obviously they don't think of themselves as the damned. They think there's a perfectly good reason for them.
But they've been spurned by the god. You know, whatever the faith is, they're the cast, the outcast. They're the other that we were talking about in the 20 Minutes With segment. They're almost an alien culture, I would think.
Almost.
Although there's trade. There's trade.
There is trade.
Okay.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, the other thing is that if, like I suggested, you've got a very long continent, maybe broken up into a few different islands, that becomes a big barrier between north and south. You either have to take stuff overland or you have to whip it all the way around the ends. And the steam power may be very important for trade because sailing ships just can't make the journey before their goods go bad.
True.
So that might be an aspect as to why this technology is jumping up here. The other thing I wanted to ask is, why steampunk? Why is the fantasy setting not good enough?
I thought it would be really cool.
that's a valid point.
I mean, that's...
Well, actually, that's, I would argue...
I think it ups the ante with it. There's a lot that you can do with your traditional clipper ships, and there's a lot that you can do with your traditional sailing, but the idea of having steampunk is that I can get away with a smaller crew if I'm looking at steampunk. When I came up with the idea of pirates that actually, take a ship and, have, if you got a flotilla and you can have a very rudimentary dry dock that you can float in and pump water out and then retrofit the hull so that it would make sense for it to be an airship. I was like, oh, that's extreme piracy. That's so cool, because then you never see that ship again. It's somewhere up above the clouds.
Yeah.
And I know, Anne, what you had said about your background being zoology. My background is actually like way, way, way back when. It's in naval architecture and hydromechanics. So that, cool. that kind of explains the whole, why is she dealing with ships?
Writing to your strengths. Well
yes.
done.
That undergrad degree is going to come in handy some way or another.
Excellent. And Veronica, let me offer my perspectives and my insights. This, first of all, holy crap, this sounds amazing. The world that you've built, with this 80% ocean and the faith of the water and the sea and the ships, those making the ships almost the priests, the intercession between the land and the divine is inspired. I love it. I love the introduction, the fringe introduction of steampunk as blasphemy. Thank you for that. That I think has incredible legs. Of course, pirates love pirates. Pirates are awesome,
especially when you put the steam technology in the hands of the pirates.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So what strikes me initially, and what I think we can offer most in this discussion, is your protagonist. You had mentioned making it an intentful protagonist, someone with an objective, and that I think is your biggest challenge right now, because right now it's not clear what her objective, what her goal is, what's going to drive her into this almost not only Machiavellian but certainly religious and cultural maelstrom that you've set up. Okay. I definitely want to explore that more.
Well, I can give you more details on that.
Okay, give us a little bit. Yeah.
All right. I was trying to keep that 8 minutes there before. the thing with Ezefin is that she is all set to go to this monastery across the sea on this pilgrimage, and I want to say university, and that's almost quite it. So pilgrimage and apprenticeship away from Wetterby. She would be happy to stay an apprentice to her father, but he's like, no, you've got to learn other things. And what actually pushes her to the no, I have to get out of here is when at the going away party, a childhood friend of hers proposes to her.
Ah.
And she's like, no, creepy. Love you, but not that way. And I'm leaving tomorrow. So she, at that point, it's the, yeah, I can't stay here. I need to go get some learning on. So once she gets over there, the apprenticeship continues to drive a wedge between her and her cousin, who the more he learns about the religion, it doesn't make sense to him. It's not logical anymore. And why is he going through all these steps for something that he doesn't believe in? Okay. So as he's questioning that, she's like, I can't give you a good answer, but this is just comfortable. And that's why I do it. And I want to learn things but you're not happy. Okay.
And how does Khalil feed into that storyline? Okay.
Khalil, the deal with that is that at the beginning, when they are setting up for their pilgrimage, which I've called a first passage, that's the first time they ever go across. In setting up for her first passage, she talks to her father about setting up trading partners. And Khalil and his father, actually, they're in Wetherby, and they go to order ships from the Wetherby shipyards. So this is a long-standing relationship between the Wetherby yards and that kingdom. And Ezefin meets this guy who's completely shrouded in robes. He looks like he's freezing cold. Okay. And probably for the poor kid he is.
Right.
And they do not hit it off well. Okay. It's the, this is ugly, this is terrible, how could you live here? And so...
That's Khalil saying this?
That Khalil, he's like, this place is horrible.
It's, so what's he doing there?
He's... the same legacy bit. His father is the one who's ordering the ships, so he is going to be in charge of the trade for his kingdom, and he's going to need to know how to order these ships, because they only order the ships from Wetherby, the best shipyard in the world.
Okay. But they're planning on adapting the ships with this steam power and committing blasphemy, right?
But we don't talk about that. They don't mention that to them, because if he knew that was going to happen, they're like, nope.
It wouldn't happen. Got it. So right. He's actually an enemy spy.
Okay.
Now, yeah.
I've lost track. These are people from where?
These are people from the Desert Kingdom.
These are people from the Desert Kingdom.
Yes.
Who are wanting to adapt the Wetherby ships for steam and air.
Yes.
Okay.
Is there another colony out there somewhere that already has the steam technology, or is it Khalil's people that are the source of this steam tech?
No. The other colonies that surround the monastery do use the steam technology.
Okay.
Have the case of where colonies are usually going to, if someone leaves a main area to go to a colony, usually they're looking at some kind of great shift in practicing faith. In this case, the shift of faith is from the main area where Wetherby is to the colonies, and in the colonies, steam is okay.
Okay. Well, and that's what really strikes me about what you've set up here. You've got the not rural, but certainly the more simple, simple machines, by hand construction, the pride and honor that comes from that set up in this predominant culture. And then you have the newness, the renegade, the fringe science of steam power and the whole steampunk aesthetic nipping at the fringes. That, I think, has a lot of mojo, just in terms of creative conflict, personal conflict, and story conflict. And I wanted to ask you, I've got a perception here, and I want to bounce it off of you. What Veronica has laid out is what I call kind of a small story in a very large location. We have very intimate stakes here. We've got a parental lineage, the daughter taking over the family business, the cousin rebelling, and this infusion, the subtle fringy infusion of outside ideas. But the world that's been created is epic and grand and has a larger story being told. How do you see such a small story fitting in such a large setting?
I mean, sometimes you have to start small to anchor the reader before you send them out into this big, wide, crazy world. I think if you've created a big world like that, ultimately you've got to go there. You've got to send your characters out and let them see it for themselves.
Absolutely.
So I think your heroine needs to go to the desert and find herself in the middle of this conflict, and maybe that's the theme, is deciding between the new and the old. Does she, as you say, mm-hmm. does she go back to her family, and also what's the basis for that conflict within herself? If she thinks it's the old ways are good, then what's apart from her cousin going, yeah, well, this is a bit weird and boring and wrong, what's her motivation for, you know, having any divided loyalties?
Absolutely.
Unless it's a romance with Khalil, which is, you know,
which
you've toyed with but weren't keen on.
Well, and then I think Anne, you've hit the nail on the head. How do we get Safi? How do we get Essefin into the center of Veronica? What you've created is this: you've caught the world at the Industrial Revolution, mm-hmm. right at the tipping point when the two primal powers that have evolved are about to come into conflict. So, how do we get Essefin into the heart of that conflict and bring her into that larger world? Doc, over to you.
Yeah, I also want to harp on the subject of travel here, because we're talking about Essefin traveling to the Lady's Heart Monastery.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all the traveling that we've talked about here. We've got people from other places. So it's like, and you've got this whole big world that we're spread out. So what's the travel plan here? Obviously, we're starting from Wetterby's and going to Lady's Heart. Are we going anywhere else from there?
Yes. I guess the overarching travel plan is from Wetterby to Lady's Heart, and then apprenticeship happens up along the coast, north, the map that I have, northwest along the coast at the different smaller yards and docks for apprenticeships, and that would either be small boat or possibly train. So to have a lot of her easing into the idea that your steam power may be okay, sort of, would be through rail transportation. Then I have actually a kidnapping of Essefin after Riddick leaves by the pirates and privateers.
Why?
To get her out. To pretty much to, I needed a villain. to actually kidnap her and get her out of Lady's Heart, because I wanted pirates. But to also show the airship bit.
Let me ask you this, Veronica. What sure. is this story about? I'm not talking about a girl's struggle to blah, blah, blah. Let's step back 30,000 feet. What okay. are the primary issues that are grinding together, creating sparks and fire for this story?
You have the question of natural and tradition versus your man-made and science.
Okay.
And
which side do you come down on?
Yeah. Okay.
Personal? Yeah. And can you, and really for Essefin at the end, can she compromise that? Can she realize that it's neither black nor white, but kind of polka dotted, checked in the middle?
Okay.
Where you can have it in moderation.
Good. Good. Mm-hmm. That's got mojo that we can work with. What do you got, Doc?
I do like the whole idea of religion versus science as embodied by Essefin and her cousin Rytek. But you mentioned that Rytek leaves.
Yes.
That he goes to Lady's Heart and they start their training, but he gets sick of it and he leaves.
Yes.
And this is, so where's he going to go? He can't stand all the religious mumbo jumbo. He's more interested in the science and the art of running a ship, and he wants to go out and do that. So isn't he going to go and join up with the pirates?
Yes, actually.
But would it be easier to involve the pirates by have her trying to chase after him?
Wait.
Yeah. Ooh, so hang on. Goes off, he joins the pirates, she chases after him, and
how about she hires the villainous merchants to go after him? Or she pleads whatever and says, no, we have to go after him. Okay, dear, we'll take you on the ship. Sure.
Sure, she has to compromise her integrity and her values.
So she wants to go after her cousin, and the person who offers her transport happens to be this terrorist network.
This sleaze, yes.
Yes, this sleaze who is probably going to try to work his own seduction angle. So you may not have a romance, but you probably have seduction angles thrown in here.
Yeah.
It also occurs to me that if you want to go with the idea of sort of a long barrier continent with various islands around, that it makes a lot of sense for the desert people to develop this, not just the steam technology, but also the airship technology, because that's a way of shortcutting across the continent.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. It may be that while the coastal lands all worship the sea, that the desert people worship more the sky. And finally, they've got the technology so that they can express their part of their religion by sailing the sky. And unfortunately, the pirates also happen to steal this technology and use it for their own needs.
Sure. I mean, you could evolve a kind of almost a winged... Oh, and that's perfect. You know, you have the main body worshiping the sea and, mm-hmm. and the terra firma, and you have the deserts worshiping the wing and the air, and maybe they have some rudimentary gliding craft that haven't incorporated the steam angle yet, but there's a whole faith of looking up and above.
Well, just hot air balloons. I mean, you can
sure,
do that.
Hot air balloons, glider craft, mm-hmm. All of that, and even, and this ties into the Arabic foundation that seems to resonate with that desert culture, if you choose to go there, right. The notion of astronomy.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. long distance, you know, telescopes, you know, maybe that's the extent of their technology and that's their emphasis. You know, you can work
The desert skies are going to be a lot clearer than all these mm-hmm. islands. So it's a much better place to do astronomy than back in, you know, where she lives.
Yeah, and that's a wonderful, again, another polarity. You've got the sky and the air versus the sea and its mysteries, whereas in the sky, everything is laid out and exposed and clear. If only your eyes were sharp enough. That's fabulous.
Yeah. Now, and then you've got the angle that when this when your sleazy merchant son finally shows his true colors, and she has her dramatic escape, then she ends up having to get help from this, I can't remember the name you used before, the desert guy, the guy who was there, Khalil.
Yeah.
She ends up joining up with Khalil in order to finish going after her cousin.
Which actually the whole star thing works perfectly, because one of the mm-hmm. one of the things that I gave Riddick at the very beginning was an astronomy chart book, a old-fashioned mm-hmm. navigator's book with the stars. And I've written like early scenes, but one is he's actually looking at that chart and trying to look out the window, waiting for his mother to actually come home.
And what if the chart is actually written in the language of the desert people?
Which would make sense, because that's part of Best's background too. So, sweet.
Nice. Awesome. I love it when a plan comes together. Now. But wait, there's more.
So, there's always more.
There's always more. So you've got this wonderful quadrangle of I'm looking from a world perspective, because that tends to be where I sit. So you've got the old religion steeped in mystery, because the sea is full of mystery. You've got these colonies that we really haven't explored, and I'm going to recommend that you do understand them as vigorously and exactly and completely as possible. But they're sitting over here representing the steam and the science and the energy. You've got the desert people that are on the fringe, but they have deep traditions, but they're also embracing of the technologies. And then you have the pirates that are playing in between all three for whatever their selfish ends are. But I strongly recommend that the pirates not be just pirates. You know, let them be the rebellion against all of the traditions. That free spirit that embodies all innovation, all human effort starts with a spark of rebellion. Because, here's why.
Okay.
You've got the maelstrom. that no one's ever been in before.
Right.
But let's say that a pirate ship fitted with steam technology and navigation tools from the desert and the good, hearty building technology of the ancient traditions has gone into the maelstrom. The first ship has gone in and come out with something and was lost. How? Who knows? Pirates attacked them. Maybe the steampunkers attacked them. Maybe the traditionalists attacked them for the blasphemy, whatever. But the cargo, whatever's in that cargo, is either the thing that will destroy one or the other culture, or a revelation into the history of the past in some way. It's some precious cargo, and it is brought to Lady's Heart Monastery at the same instant that Safi and Riddick and Khalil come to that monastery.
I got it.
Go.
Sorry. Squeal. Squeal person. Okay. I know I had, this had been one of my questions. I was putting together steampunk stuff and actually coming up with a good power source. What if you have, some sort of, you know, material. I know most steam runs on coal or coke, but you've got some other small, highly charged, mineral piece, what have you, small glowing chunk of rock
stuff
that when combined with something very, you know, salt, who knows? So maybe you take that, put salt on it, and you can fit that into, you know, whatever piece, and it provides an immense amount of heat and energy. So Bam. It winds up being this perfect heat source, which sure. could be interpreted from the religious side as the actual lady's heart.
Ooh.
So a nice glowing thing. Mm-hmm. So some life force that we should not mess with, the life force, because this is sacred. And how dare you try to use that for your own personal gain versus, dude, this would be awesome in an engine.
Yeah.
So this is not just something that has recently come, but this is like an ancient artifact from the time when the ship people and the desert people were more closer related as one people, and someone braved the maelstrom and returned with this, and the monastery's been built around this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then when mm-hmm. when these people come, then we have a pirate raid and they steal the lady's heart.
Oh, that's awesome.
And at the time that the pirates raid and steal the lady's heart, Ritek, because he doesn't care about this mumbo jumbo, he joins up with them and he goes with them.
And he's uniquely qualified to work with the lady's heart for some reason or other. So he's the perfect guy. So he becomes the nemesis.
Oh, man. And there's
He wants the villain.
So now
you want the villain.
The great thing about this is now your pirates really are blasphemers. They're blaspheming against the sea and the air.
Right.
So we've re-upped the religious themes here and awesome. maybe Rytek is the only one who can really grasp the lady's heart because a non-believer.
Or the other thing. Well, here's the other thing. What the big reason that he's so bitter is because he was actually born on a ship. Mm-hmm. His mother's been a captain of the family ships for forever, and he was actually born on the ship. And the fact that the ship made it back to port and he was alive and his mother was alive, this was like some amazing blessing. Oh my gosh, the lady has blessed you. You better not tempt it again. So the part of the lore is that a mother and her son may not be on the ship at the same time because the lady, how did I write it? Since she was unable to have that sort of kinship with her own son who went mm-hmm. away and never returned, you know, goddesses are malevolent. She doesn't want to see anybody else that happy. So the entire passage, the sailors are freaking out because, oh my gosh, there's going to be a storm. We're all going to get swallowed up because you're bringing your kid with you. Are you nuts, lady? So he's already got this, you know, deal of, well, they won't want to deal with me because, you know, I've already gone against so much lore, but I'm fine. So screw you. But that's the reason he can handle that. More religious people may consider, oh, well, he can handle it because he's blessed. Look at all these things that happened. He's like, no, I'm picking it up. Jeez.
Mm-hmm. Now,
and Esafin is the one who gets handed the task of retrieving the heart and bringing it home, because,
well, you know, if in the fight nobody's left to do so, she's the only one that has the knowledge to go forward, to take action in the attack on Lady's Heart Monastery.
Well, there's also the aspect that, okay, it was her cousin, so if she can bring it back, she'll redeem her family's name.
Or she needs to go, she wants to go do it first because she knows that if anyone else does it, they're going to kill him.
Yeah.
Or she discovers something that that causes her to question the long-standing traditions that she's always honored, and she's torn. She, you know, maybe Riddick is right. Maybe I should go over here, but here's my tradition, and some lore, some other thing. There needs to be one. Right now we've got a nice, clear adventure arc. We need one more thing to tuck in there.
You've got this, you seem to have this whole thing of, oh, yeah, you can't touch the sacred lady's heart, you know, probably, you know, mm-hmm. salt in your skin, it's, you know, in your sweat, you can't touch it. And then he just goes up and takes it, and mm-hmm. you know, that's going to kind of shatter her belief system a little, mm-hmm. I think.
Very much so.
And make her question everything she's believed. You know, on the one hand, she wants to redeem her family's name by going and getting it back.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, she's seen him do this thing and not be killed or whatever the tradition says.
Now, Anne, I wanted to ask, when Veronica started this out, there was, it's more of a historical fantasy than a historical, an alternate history rather than a fantasy. But Veronica, you had mentioned a subtle magic at play underneath, right?
Not quite. I never know where fantasy stops and starts unless okay. it's very much in your face.
Well, then Anne, you were confronted by angry robots who said we need more magic in this story. Do you see a place in the terrain that's evolving through this discussion where maybe on the traditionalist, you know, ocean water goddess side, some magic could come into play?
I'm not sure that steampunk necessarily needs magic. I mean, the whole, you know, made up minerals and stuff, it's, you know, is science fantasy anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not hard SF by any.
True. Although you could argue that, you know, with steampunk being, you know, at its most fantastical pseudoscience, it's still very sciencey.
Yeah.
Would enhancing, if we're going to enhance the conflict between the old school and the new, would incorporating, you know, maybe a subtle or a deep magic reaffirm and ratchet up that conflict?
Ooh, I find it hard to say. I mean, it's, you know, put it in there if you feel it fits.
Sure.
Let me throw out something and see if it kind of resonates in terms of just adding just a touch of magic to emphasize the whole the divide between magic and religion and technology. What if part of the reason why you have certain families who are very much into this realm of making ships and running ships is because they do have that touch of magic, and their particular magic is a wind sense, that they are attuned to the weather and they can sense the storms coming, and the more powerful of them can actually affect the storms so that their ships go through. And they don't get destroyed in the storms.
Because that kind of harkens back to like a Marion Zimmer Bradley, oh God, what was the series?
Actually, I'm lifting it pretty Darkover. Much wholly out of the Wheel of Time series, where they have windfinders. They have a society of people who live on ships, and they're women who can touch the source. In that story, they're windfinders, and they... The low powers, they can sense where the winds are and when the storms are coming. And the high level, they can create wind when there is none. So.
Right. Well, and the reason I bring this up is I love and the idea of the maelstrom. I really think that's that having that dark, deep mystery just adds it's a portal of inviting exploration and adventure. And it kind of opens the door, you know, we've kind of been dancing around it through the discussion of what is the history of this world and the cultures that are there, you know? And V, one of the things I didn't get a chance to ask, and we're running out of time, but something about the religion that exists here, where it came from, what its roots are, because religion evolves over the millennia, and these cultures have evolved over the millennia, you know, and the maelstrom could be, you know, I don't want to go with like necessarily an Atlantis thing, you know, that's a little trite, but it could be the key to unlocking not only a greater mystery and the heritage of the world, but also a danger, a broader danger that affects everyone. You know, what if the world wasn't always 80% water? What if it used to be a much more balanced environment, and something that the ancients did is causing the water levels to rise?
Going back to the science again, you know, a world with that much land, I don't know whether it's big enough to support a varied land fauna that could, you know,
evolve life. Yeah.
So the question is,
If you want it to stay more science, then you've got to come up with some explanation as to why you've got people on this, this water planet.
Doc, so what were you going to say?
It may be that the maelstrom goes somewhere else.
Yeah, or is the heart?
That would be another book afterwards.
But. Oh yeah, you know, maybe it's the heart of you know. We're obviously talking about some sort of environmental catastrophe that is causing the polar caps to melt in some way, if you want to go that way. I mean, keep it in the science realm, which I agree. I was tossing out the fantasy magic question, and I like it, but you know, if we can tie it back into that science, you know, maybe this is actually a culture. These cultures are the last of a very highly technological land planet. And this is the tail end of the planet. What happens when you have a global catastrophe and the world is thrown back into this archaic technology and the more rooted cultural bondings that we go to during those times of crisis? And the story that you're telling, V, is Safi being the gatekeeper, the threshold that brings the world either to its final ending or its salvation. I think that's a much bigger story than you came here talking about, isn't it?
It is, but yeah.
That's the third trilogy.
The whole initial idea for the story years and years ago, I was actually trying to build a world for an original RPG that was called Rising Tides. So I was actually coming up with the ice caps melting and water covering every place. So guys, get out of my head. There's barely no room for me in there.
Yeah. It's so warm and comfy.
I know. The walls are mushy. Wonderful place.
Well, guys, our time has run out, unfortunately. Let's just take one more run around the table. Anne, any final words or observations or inspirations for Veronica on her story?
I'm just pondering the whole post-apocalyptic steampunk concept. I think it has legs.
I think so too. I think so too. Doc, what about you? Any final words for Veronica?
I think we've got a really interesting story that we've managed to hammer out here, and I look forward to seeing it.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Veronica, we don't have these kind of discussions, this animated, this vibrant, with when we've got nothing to work with. So clearly you've got some serious chops in terms of a story structure. There's a lot more to explore. And I just, from hearing your side of the discussion, I think you have a lot to work with and chew on. Mm-hmm. But definitely exploring, finding and ensuring that the themes that you're working on, that you know, religion versus technology, that tradition versus innovation, those conflicts, making sure that you're clear, you know, what you want to say about those, and then placing Safi, making sure she's right square in the middle of it, and making her stakes as big and tied as closely to her heart as possible as the story unfolds, you know, torment the poor girl.
I'm good at tormenting characters. I can do that much.
I've heard that about you. That's awesome. You know,
and put those hooks in her heart and take them two different directions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Finding out, exploring the religion, exploring the histories of the cultures, the history of the world itself. You know, you've got characters that embody the key themes, I think, already. The question is now just to move forward. I think. As has been said by everyone else, this baby's got legs, and we're all looking forward to seeing where you run with it.
Okay.
No pressure.
No pressure at all.
Awesome. Well, we always exact a vow from all of our guest writers when they come on, that when you do write this thing, and it turns into this epic sweeping saga that renovates and revitalizes genre fiction in general, and you're standing there at your Hugo, Nebula, Parsec, and all of those awards, we exact a vow that you will come back to us and tell us so that we can put you on our golden hall of fame of writers who have gone on to greatness. Do you solemnly vow this?
I do solemnly vow that I will return and extol your praises.
Yes. Score. And it's on record. We've got it. Excellent. Very cool. Well, Anne, thank you so much for sitting down at the round table and joining in and kicking us off and sustaining the spark and fire of the conversation. I hope you had as much fun as we did.
I did. It's interesting listening to that story.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And this process never gets old. Never gets old. So, friends, do look for Anne's book, Alchemist of Souls, the first of the Nightmask trilogy, on shelves now. Merchant of Dreams coming out at the end of December, beginning of January, depending on where you are in the world. And the Prince of Lies emerging in the distant shadows of the future ahead. Doc, thank you so much for being guest co-host on this episode. It has been a genuine pleasure, sir.
It's been my pleasure. I look forward to doing it again if Brian goes and gets himself lost in the woods again. And I foresee a bright future for my new career as a Brian Humphrey impersonator.
Yes! Holy crap! I think that has legs too. And Doc, where can our listeners find out more about you on the web?
The best place to start off is by going to www.doccoleman.com, and from there you'll find links to everything I'm doing.
Outstanding. Veronica, where can we find you on the web, lady?
You can find me at www.voicesbyveronica.com, and you can follow me on Twitter as V4Voice, V4Voice. And if you're looking for someone to read your next novel, novella, or short story, you can go to acx.com and search for Veronica Jaguar.
See, and I had a lump of chocolate sitting on my desk, and it's melted. Mm-hmm. It's just a puddle of chocolate. That's amazing. Anne, did you want to get in on this URL fest? Where can we find
Absolutely.
You on the web?
I'm online at www.annlyle.com.
Excellent.
Unsurprisingly. And on Twitter, at annlyle.
Fabulosity, gloriosity, and wonderment abounds.
I guess I should throw my Twitter in there. I'm on Twitter at Scalesley, Scalesla.
Excellent. Yes. So now we can all just get together and continue the delight.
And of course, Dave, you're on Twitter as?
At Writers Podcast.
Okay.
At Writers Podcast, and of course, roundtablepodcast.com. Ding. Dear friends, wow, this is, I'm gonna light up a cigarette and just kind of bask in the glow of this particular episode. writerly goodness abounds. I hope you had as much fun as we did. Throw a comment. If you have ideas for Veronica's story, please, we haven't got the forums up, but man, I can see us needing forums in the near future. But for now, go to roundtablepodcast.com, find the you're already looking at this link, hopefully, this post. Throw a comment at the bottom. V, I'll definitely make sure you know when comments come up, and I'm sure they will. Go out to iTunes. Show us some love, people. We love to know that you're out there. I just found out that we actually had 3,000 downloads of episodes in the month of May.
Wow, congratulations.
I know, that's freaking awesome. This is just mind-blowing that we've been out for so shortly and we've got such a wonderful base of fans. So show us a little more love if you're so inclined. Yeah, ask for more, Dave. That's brilliant. go out to iTunes, give us a review, or at least click that star rating, whatever you think we're worth, put it up there. Send us an email, thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. I still aspire to a feedback show someday, and I can't do that without feedback from you guys. Hopefully in the near future, Brian will be back on the show. He was missed at Balticon. He's still missed, and we can only hope to fill his shoes until he returns. Special thanks, and thank you, Doc. Thank you, Veronica. Thank you. Thank yous all around, and to you, dear friends, for tuning in. Come back in a few days. We'll have another amazing guest host, more amazing stories to workshop. Until then, Doc, any suggestions?
Well, go right.
the Brian Humphrey legacy lives on. Yeah. Go right. Look for awesomeness and you will find it. Until next time, friends, thank you so much. We will talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast, or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.